It's called presidential harassment.
I want nothing.
And it's unfortunate.
I want no quid pro quo.
This should never, ever happen to another president, ever.
I don't know. I haven't spoken to Rudy. I spoke to him yesterday briefly. He's a very good attorney, and he has been my attorney. Yeah, sure.
Shut up, Rudy.
Shut up.
Okay, hold on.
Shut up.
You don't know what you're talking about.
What they've done to General Flynn.
Russia.
What they've done to others.
It was all bull.
This is Josh Barrow, host of KCRW's Left, Right, and Center. You're listening to All the President's Lawyers, the podcast about all of President Trump's legal issues. And Ken White is with me, as always. Ken is my co-host, a criminal defense attorney and former federal prosecutor, and he blogs at popehat.com. Hello, Ken.
Hello, Josh.
How is quarantine treating you so far?
Well, the kids are like three rats in a basket, constantly at each other's throats. But as long as they go into the room and hog all the bandwidth, it's going okay.
Okay. Well, not too bad considering then. I want to start this week with a listener question. This question comes from Ken Irwin. Hello, Ken, not Ken White. He says, will you please talk about the emergency powers requested by the Department of Justice? Last week's conversation gave us a good look at how the courts are affected by this time of crisis. It was a useful reminder that courts are mostly in-person proceedings, so it makes sense that things like the right to speedy trial might be slowed down. But if they're looking to suspend habeas corpus and start doing indefinite detention, that sounds outside the realm of a reasonable response. How would that assist DOJ? Does that help avert a crisis, or does this just soften us up for ever-increasing fascism? So Ken White, Ken Irwin's question refers to a Politico story that a lot of people have been alarmed about. The story ran on March 21. The headline was DOJ seeks new emergency powers amid coronavirus pandemic. And the story said in part, the Department of Justice has quietly asked Congress for the ability to ask chief judges to detain people indefinitely without trial during emergencies. Now, when the Politico story ran, it drew swiftly negative reaction from a lot of officials on both sides of the aisle in Congress. Utah Republican Senator Mike Lee, for example, tweeted, "Over my dead body." But Berkeley Law Professor Orrin Kerr, who's been on this show with us, thought a lot of people were misunderstanding DOJ's request and that it's a lot less broad than it initially sounded. So can you lay out for us what powers is the Department of Justice actually asking for here?
Well, Josh, one of the crucial problems here in answering that question is that we don't have the primary documents. Politico apparently had a copy of the Department of Justice's request and characterized it, but it has not, as far as I can tell, been released. Now, Betsy Woodruff Swan, who's a reporter who broke this, is an excellent legal reporter. I have a lot of respect for her. But my sense is this may be a situation where people not familiar with some of the rules being discussed are misreading what the Department of Justice is asking for. There are a lot of things that judges can do, federal judges and state judges, already under existing law. And the Department of Justice's spokesperson has basically said that this is a proposal to let the chief judge of any district exercise some of these rules so that they'll be done consistently across all criminal cases in any particular federal district. So just as an example, we talked before about how under the Speedy Trial Act, which is a federal statute that governs how quickly you have to go to trial, there are exceptions for emergencies, and this would very much be the sort of situation that would be invoked so that you don't get to go to trial within 70 days, as you normally do. The Department of Justice is suggesting what they're doing is allowing the chief judge of any district to invoke that rule rather than each individual judge invoking it separately in each different criminal case. Now, it's always good to read the Justice Department's spokespeople with a grain of salt. It's always good to be skeptical, but to do that effectively, we have to see the primary documents, and we haven't yet. So I think it's too early to tell. It may simply be that they're looking for a way to regulate the response to this and to have a way so that it's consistent throughout a particular district.
Yeah, I mean, you were talking some last week about the way that this is somewhat chaotic, that different courts are handling this situation in different ways. And so the idea or the version of this request that would not be alarming would be basically to say we're not asking for any new powers for judges. We're just changing which judge exercises the power so that, you know, for all of the federal cases that are ongoing right now in Los Angeles, that will have the same timeline, the same rules in terms of what's suspended, what's delayed?
Exactly. Another way to put it would be that they may be looking to make more explicit that various existing rules apply to this situation. So there are already rules saying that normal deadlines can be extended or suspended in times of crisis. So what they may be looking is just something more explicit saying, yeah, a global pandemic is such a crisis and these rules apply here. You know, there's the way this was reported is that, oh my gosh, Department of Justice is trying to suspend habeas corpus. It's trying to get around our constitutional rights. You know, Congress can't simply waive constitutional rights by a statute. So I don't think that's correct. We should, of course, be vigilant and suspicious, but there's a tendency in crisis in America to look at suggested legal changes and not put them in context. So this is reminding me a little bit about what happened after the Patriot Act and after 9/11. A lot of people looked at some of the legal measures that were passed after 9/11 and were horrified and thought this is a gigantic grab for power by the Department of Justice, a gigantic expansion of criminal justice power. And people who are already in the system said, well, no, not exactly. It's more of a tweak. But a lot of what you're looking at and horrified by was already in place. They're just shuffling it around a little bit. I think that may be the case here as well.
But so is that the case here? I mean, if we're talking about a situation where they're not really looking so much for an expansion of powers as a reorganization of powers that actually exist already, are those powers currently being used in a reasonable manner? Do you think courts are generally making good choices about what to delay and how to delay it in this crisis?
I think that very much depends on which court you're asking about and what type of case. So in federal court, federal judges are fairly notorious for moving cases along more quickly. And so it's fairly rare for a federal criminal defendant against their will to be forced to wait a long time, particularly in custody, for a federal trial. Contrast that, though, with state courts, and particularly state courts in high-volume jurisdictions, perhaps most notoriously New York City, where it's routine for people to wait in custody for a long time while judges continually give the prosecution delay after delay after delay on the grounds that, you know, there's a problem with a witness or something. So there's already a lot of injustice surrounding this type of thing. This just may be a situation that tends to highlight it.
Can we talk a little bit about what this situation means for civil litigation? I mean, obviously, you don't have the same sort of due process concerns. You don't have the same speedy trial concerns in a civil case that you have in a criminal case. I imagine that means that civil litigation is being even more seriously stalled and delayed by this situation. I guess, what does that mean if you are a civil litigant, either with a valid claim against someone or you are a defendant in a civil action and this thing is going to hang over your head for a long time? And then I assume also there's going to be some issue where, you know, as we come out of this, what capacity the courts have, I assume they have to move first on the criminal matters. So it seems like this could be a really big wrench in all sorts of civil lawsuits.
It can be. Now, in a lot of places, Josh, civil and criminal matters are handled by different judges. In federal court, of course, the judges handle both. So I think you're right there. We'll see a lot of slowdown in civil cases even after this pandemic as judges catch up on criminal matters, which take precedence. You know, a large amount of my practice is civil litigation. And what we're seeing is reasonable lawyers generally trying to work together and agree on moving deadlines and agree on what can be done remotely and on paper. You know, for instance, we're in the middle of negotiating in a bunch of cases that we can serve each other with documents by email instead of by old-fashioned snail mail, which frankly is something everyone should have done a long time ago anyway. But right now, I think the biggest thing you see happening is people canceling things like depositions, events where people would have to be together in a room someplace. And more than that, it's affecting very much strategy. So, you know, it's all very well to threaten, if you don't do this, I'm going to sue. But now the response to that is you're going to sue, you know, where? Well, when do you think you're going to get a hearing? August? So it affects a lot of strategy. It affects a lot of the ability to threaten to use the legal system. And it has a pretty profound impact on the normal flow of cases.
On that note, let's talk about some of the civil lawsuits that we follow that may be having their own timelines affected by this. Let's start with the lawsuit where the House of Representatives is seeking the president's tax records, which Treasury Secretary Steve Mnuchin has refused to provide, despite a law that allows the House Ways and Means Committee to request tax returns for its review. Federal Judge Trevor McFadden has hit pause on that lawsuit. He's basically said, let's wait and see what the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals does with a separate lawsuit over whether former White House counsel Don McGahn must comply with a congressional subpoena. There are some of the same legal issues in this case, and so he wants to see what happens with that case first. That case is supposed to be reheard en banc, which is to say the entire D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals is supposed to consider that case, which already was considered by a three-judge panel of that court. So we're waiting for that. I assume that that's likely to get delayed because of the coronavirus delays that are running throughout the federal judicial system. After we have the en banc rehearing, conceivably there could be a Supreme Court appeal. And then once the McGahn case is done, then I assume you'd have to go back and have litigation on the tax record case itself to apply whatever precedents come out of the McGahn case to the tax records case. So it seems like that's a long road ahead for this case, right?
Very much so. But I don't really see this as an issue with the pandemic. It's more kind of judicial caution and conservatism, where the trial judge is saying that, you know, this is the same issue that's being worked out by higher courts. We're looking for an en banc hearing by the D.C. Circuit, which at least in the mind is the next best thing to a Supreme Court ruling. It may go to the Supreme Court. Why would I, a district court judge, want to reinvent the wheel on this and get out in front of something that higher level judges are imminently about to decide? So I think that's actually a pretty reasonable decision. Otherwise, you just have multiple appeals happening at once, and that doesn't really help anybody. In the grand scheme of things, I think that Court of Appeals matters are better equipped to move forward swiftly than our trial court matters. Almost everything the Court of Appeals does can be done remotely. So it doesn't require, you know, live questioning of witnesses or trials. The types of hearings courts of appeal do could pretty easily be done by teleconference. You know, skeptics would say they don't really have to be done at all. And the types of legal work courts of appeals do are uniquely well suited for being done all online. So my hope is that the business of the nation's Court of Appeals will continue on not too much delayed compared to the business of the trial courts.
So can you say that those things can be done remotely? Are they being done remotely? Because I know in the case of the Supreme Court, there's been a delay in a number of arguments. Are the courts of appeals basically continuing saying, let's do this on the phone?
I think the courts right now, most of them are figuring that out. I've seen a number of courts where they're basically orders maintaining the status quo for a month or so and saying all deadlines are suspended and hearings are canceled. But it appears that some of the federal courts of appeal are moving towards possible online video arguments. So that Zoom account you're paying $15 a month for may come in useful for constitutional purposes before you know it.
It seems likely to me that in the case of this tax records lawsuit, that the clock is going to run all the way down past the election in terms of determining whether the president has to hand over these tax records. So what happens if the president loses re-election? Will we ever find out the outcome of this, whether presidents have to comply with these congressional requests for their tax records, or will the case be moot if in the very likely event that there isn't a final decision by November and then he loses and then, you know, presumably the congressional request for his tax records is moot.
Well, I mean, I'm not sure that it is moot. The Congress has the ability to continue to investigate things, can continue to investigate just about anybody. It may be politically moot. They may decide that they don't want to devote the time and attention and controversy to going after somebody who's out of office and no longer relevant. But that can change on a dime, as we saw when Congress that had seemed to have pretty much forgotten who Hunter Biden is suddenly took great interest in investigating him when Joe Biden performed very well in some primaries. So I think Congress would retain the power to continue and investigate former President Trump. The question is whether they would want to bother and spend the political capital on it.
Let's take a break. When we come back, we can talk about presidential depositions in the time of the coronavirus. You're listening to All the President's Lawyers. This is Josh Barrow, and I'm back with attorney Ken White on All the President's Lawyers. There is another legal problem President Trump has that we haven't talked about very much on this show. The president used to endorse a multi-level marketing network called ACN. He even pushed it on The Celebrity Apprentice, and several plaintiffs are suing, saying the president defrauded them into losing money by participating in ACN. I believe we talked about this lawsuit previously, mostly because the plaintiffs made a civil RICO claim against the president, and Ken, you were right, this was not RICO. Whatever the president may or may not have done here, a federal judge tossed the idea that you could sue him as a racketeer for his multi-level marketing dealings. But the plaintiff's claims for fraud survived, and they're now moving on to discovery in this lawsuit. Their attorney, Roberta Kaplan, who is famous for representing gay marriage plaintiff Edie Windsor, has served the president with a notice demanding a deposition at the White House on May 1st. So, Ken, let's start with the case law here. This was the issue in Clinton v. Jones, the Paula Jones lawsuit against President Clinton while he was in office. If you're lodging a civil lawsuit against the president, you may be able to force him to sit for a deposition. In that case, the answer from the Supreme Court was yes, you can make President Bill Clinton sit for a deposition. So what does that tell us about what might happen in this case?
Well, it tells us that it is very plausible that eventually they'll be able to depose President Trump. But one thing about the Clinton versus Jones lawsuit is that the court made it pretty clear that obviously you're going to have to accommodate the president to a larger extent than you are a normal witness. Judges in general have the power to make special conditions for depositions and to spare people from harassment and that type of thing. That's why, you know, it doesn't take any special law to say that if I sue McDonald's for a bad Big Mac, I don't get to depose the CEO automatically. A judge can prevent that. The same thing applies to the president on an even bigger scale. And the Supreme Court in Clinton versus Jones said basically that, you know, if a court's going to allow someone to depose the president, obviously that court should take into account the president's schedule and security concerns and all that type of thing. So I think it's unlikely that this deposition is going to happen anytime soon, like by May 1st, because there are going to be extraordinary measures available to the president to delay it, to put conditions on it, to limit its time, and so forth.
Yeah, so if there has to be consideration for the president's busy schedule, I have to imagine the president is busier than usual right now. Can he basically say, there's a pandemic, I have no time for a deposition until the pandemic is over?
Absolutely. I mean, he's got important tasks to do. Just this morning, he's been very busy mocking Michael Avenatti for not getting out of jail and mocking Mitt Romney for a negative coronavirus test. And I mean, that type of business would go undone if you were allowed to be deposed. So yes, I think
But wait, I mean, you make that sort of as a joke, but I guess, you know, is the question for the court, is the president busy? Or is the question for the court, should the president be busy? I mean, does it really enter into the analysis like the president wastes a bunch of time on Twitter that indicates that he has time for a deposition?
Well, I mean, yes, I am being somewhat facetious, but I do think it could eventually play into a court's analysis. If the president pushed back hard enough about my schedule is so busy, I can't possibly do it, you know, in calendar 2020, then I think you might get some analysis of just how busy is the president really. But I think the president is going to enjoy a far higher presumption of being very busy than almost anyone else.
And then aside from him being president, I assume depositions of all kinds are on hold right now. I mean, can you conduct a deposition over Zoom? It seems to me the normal deposition model where you sit around a table together is not really compliant with social distancing requirements.
Absolutely. A lot of legal rules have not caught up with the digital age. And normally, depositions are held in person. There's nothing that says they can't be, if the parties agree to it, be held by Zoom or some other method. But I can tell you that lawyers really don't like doing a deposition that way. Defense attorneys love defending a deposition like that, but you lose a lot of control over the witness and ability to perceive the witness's reactions and control over the process if you're doing a deposition by video. I wouldn't do it with any crucial witness, and Trump in this case is definitely a crucial witness. I think that almost anyone would rather wait than have the impact of a deposition be blunted by doing it over video.
But I mean, in this instance, I mean, Roberta Kaplan, the plaintiff's attorney here, resides in New York City. The president's top health advisors, Deborah Birx and Anthony Fauci, were at the White House this week saying that people who live in New York should self-isolate for 2 weeks if they leave the city. That would seem like a good argument right now for why the president should not sit for an in-person deposition on top of the general social distancing requirements. Now, obviously, it's not May 1st, and we don't know exactly what the situation is likely to be on May 1st, but it seems like if the plaintiffs really want an in-person deposition here, that might give the president another good set of arguments about why it would not be proper to make him sit for an in-person deposition right now.
Oh, absolutely. But I don't think May 1st was ever a remotely plausible date. The plaintiff generally, or whoever is taking the deposition, generally doesn't get to unilaterally pick a date. And when it's the president of the United States, you definitely don't get to pick the date unilaterally. You know, I wouldn't anticipate, even now that they have a ruling that this can happen, that this would, even under normal non-pandemic circumstances, happen earlier than, you know, 1, 2, 3, 4 months after that, at some time that they can get the president to agree to it. You have to bear in mind that it's a delicate negotiation. If you push too hard as the person seeking this deposition, they're just going to appeal it and drag it out forever in an appeal. And so, you know, you have to do something that is reasonably accommodating if you don't want that to happen.
So this seems like another thing that is likely to get pushed until after the election. If and when the president is deposed in this case, will we get to see that deposition transcript? Will that be a public document?
Unless there is a protective order, then it would not be a secret document. It would not be something that would be automatically filed on the court record. It would only get put into the court record if it were used as an exhibit to some motion or something like that, commonly a summary judgment motion. But unless there's a protective order, it's a public document, and the people taking the deposition are free to release it.
The president still can't block you on Twitter. A trial judge and a unanimous 3-judge appellate panel had previously ruled public officials can't block their critics. The administration had sought reconsideration by the entire Second Circuit Court of Appeals en banc. That's when all the judges on the court consider a case together. The request was denied, although there were two Trump-appointed judges who wanted to take the case up again. Judge Michael Park, one of the judges who wanted to revisit the decision, said, "The First Amendment's guarantee of free speech does not include a right to post on other people's personal social media accounts, even if those other people happen to be public officials." So Ken, that seems related to some arguments that I've made here in the past, basically that, you know, if you're a public official and you're curating whose comments can appear below your own tweets, that's your speech. And so there's not a First Amendment right to not be excluded from that. But it seems that's the minority view within the Second Circuit Court of Appeals. And so the president still cannot block people on Twitter.
Sure. I mean, this is a good example of how we develop a legal doctrine based on one level of technology. We wind up with another level of technology, and all of a sudden it winds up differently than we anticipated. What the dissenters here are saying is that when Trump blocks somebody on Twitter, he's not exercising a government power, an official government power. He's, in effect, exercising the same power that any private person on Twitter has the ability to do. They analogized it more to what Trump chooses to talk about. So it's well understood there's not a First Amendment right to tell the president what he has to talk about or make the president respond to you when you yell things at him or things like that. And what the dissent says is that by blocking people, the president's engaging more in his own private speech than he is exercising any sort of government power. You know, it's not a perfectly easy question because this circumstance, this technological innovation, just is not anticipated by prior First Amendment law. So I think this is going to eventually get to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court is going to say, well, is the president's Twitter feed, or more precisely, the reactions to it, is that more like a town hall that the government has rented, or is it more like the president's own press release and the contents of that press release?
Finally, we talked last week about Michael Cohen's request to be let out of prison because of the risk that a coronavirus outbreak in prison could create a hazardous condition there. That request, I gather, has been denied.
It has been, and in rather blunt terms. This was part of Cohen's ongoing effort to get out early, and he really has been throwing everything he can find against the wall to see what could stick, from the idea that he should be let out because of government misconduct to the idea that he should be let out because time has further demonstrated how he was right about how bad the president is, and most recently to how he should be out early because of the dangers of the coronavirus. The judge was fairly merciless and said more or less that all of this seems to be really attention-seeking on Cohen's part, particularly the most recent coronavirus thing, and it seems to be an attempt to get back into a news cycle, which is a pretty rough language for a judge to be using about someone at this point. But the judge bought none of it. In a similar issue, this week, Michael Avenatti sought to get out of custody while he was awaiting a trial. He asked the judge in California federal court, who you might remember is the one who put him in custody, and that judge also refused, saying that he had not demonstrated that he was under any special danger from the coronavirus while in custody. Of course, everyone in the in custody, federal or state, is in grave danger from the coronavirus, in part because the circumstances naturally increase transmission risks. There is no social distancing in custody, and in part because the healthcare there is so terrifyingly bad.
But not especially dangerous for Avenatti and for Cohen compared to other criminals, right? You'd have to make a showing that that you faced a particular risk rather than just that the system as a whole is risky, right?
Exactly. And I mean, I have sympathy for both of these men not wanting to be in custody where it's going to increase the risk, let's be blunt, of them dying. But on the other hand, I have the sympathy for the hundreds of thousands of more people in custody who don't have the resources to make those special pleas.
Can we talk a little bit about Avenatti's request? Because his circumstance is different from Cohen's in that he's still awaiting two out of the three criminal trials that he was facing. He's been convicted in the first trial. And so I guess it looks like both of his criminal trials, the one that he's waiting for in California about stealing money from certain clients, and the one that he's waiting for in New York that has to do with stealing Stormy Daniels' book advance specifically, those trials are likely to be delayed. He wanted to be held on house arrest awaiting the California trial. Why would he be able to get out when he's already been convicted of a number of very serious crimes in his first trial?
Well, so even if you've been found guilty at trial or even entered a guilty plea, you can still get bail. The analysis shifts somewhat because there's no longer a presumption of innocence, but it's not unknown, not even that unusual for people to be on bail pending sentencing, particularly when they behave themselves on bail before trial. But it does make the argument harder, and that's the circumstance in which Avenatti finds himself. And of course, in California, he's up against the fact that this very judge found that he had committed new crimes, or there was probable cause to believe he'd committed new crimes while out on bail. And of course, that was the basis to revoke his bail.
Right. His bail got revoked before he was even convicted in the first trial that he faced. There is much more for us to talk about, but I think that's a good place for us to leave it this week. Ken White, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Take care, Josh.
If you have questions about the president's lawyers and his legal issues, please send them to us. You can find us on Twitter at LRCKCRW. You can also leave us voicemail at 424-538-8888. While you're waiting at home, not doing very much, this might be a really good time to leave some voicemails. All the President's Lawyers is produced by Sarah Fay. Our technical director is JC Swadek. Todd M. Simon composed our theme music. I'm Josh Barrow. Thanks for joining us, and Ken and I will be back next week with more All the President's Lawyers.